The Big Wake Up by Mark Coggins is what you hope every private eye novel will be, says Edgar Award-winning author Megan Abbott. Find it in ebook or trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com. Chapter 20, Sleeping Beauty's Castle. Once I got the Escalade on Interstate 80, pointed towards the Bay Bridge, I explained to Chris about the text message I'd gotten from Isis.
"That's horrible, August,"
he said.
"Maybe I should carry the gun."
"I hope it doesn't come to that. But if we can find Evita and trade her for Melina, then I'm going to do it. I'm not going to worry about the Riveros or General Vilas or the cops or creating a diplomatic stink between the U.S. and Argentina. I'm just going to get Melina back safely and damn the consequences. But whatever goes down, I know I can't deal with ISIS unarmed. Hence the hardware." Chris nodded and looked out the window as we passed the famous Yahoo imitation of a Holiday Inn billboard with a "nice place to stay" written in neon script.
"I can't guarantee we'll find Evita,"
he said,
"but I did find some encouraging signs on the internet."
"Let's hear 'em."
"I decided to start with the question of transferring ownership of a family mausoleum. Turns out it's possible under certain circumstances. A living relative can sell a mausoleum or gravesite if his parents are the only ones in it. But it can't be sold if it would require more distant family members to be disinterred."
"So a child can kick out his parents, but he can't go after Grandma or Uncle Charlie."
"That's the idea."
We passed onto the lower deck of the Bay Bridge, the Escalade's wheels jolting over the temporary roadway that had been laid down as part of the long-running seismic retrofit. I'm not sure that helps us much. Arrowhead crossed off the 7 names on the list I gave you because they were buried in big family mausoleums or plots. Given the age of the cemetery, it's hard to believe any of them housed just a single generation, even back in the early 70s.
"Yeah, you're right. I checked into it. The newest mausoleum on the list was built in the 20s by a wealthy doctor when his teenage son died. There were 2 generations in it in the 70s and 3 now."
"Swell. Did you say something about encouraging?" Chris pretended to buff the nails of one hand on his shirt and looked down to admire the pretend shine.
"I did, didn't I? Remember your joke about taking on long-term boarders?"
"Did you find the Pena family took one on?"
"No. I think you got too wrapped up in the coincidence of Esmeralda Pena having the same initials as Evita. That would be a little obvious, wouldn't it?"
"Okay, wise guy. What would be less obvious?"
"How about hiding Evita among the Morgenstern family?"
I grunted. "Good camouflage, particularly given the rumors about the Perones being Nazi sympathizers. But how do you figure she's there?"
"I don't know she's there. But while researching the family, I ran across an old article in the Oakland Tribune archives. It seems Joel Morgenstern, last of the Morgenstern line, twice divorced and down on his luck, was looking to raise money in 1973. He decided to tack up a for sale sign on the family crypt, offering to sell the spots where his parents were resting. That pissed off families of other Mountain View residents and the then manager of the cemetery, but attracted the eye of a reporter who wrote up a human interest story. The article doesn't say whether Morgenstern had any takers, but the reporter ends with a pithy quote from him saying, 'For $100,000, anyone's welcome to join the family.'"
I put on the turn signal and went around a Toyota with a Berkeley parking sticker and a veritable zoo of plastic animal figurines glued to the trunk. That was 1973. We know from Arrow's list there was a Morgenstern buried in the mausoleum in 74. I don't remember the first name of the person Arrow gave me, but you said Joel was the last of the line.
"That's right. Joel was supposed to be last. Yet 1 year later, there's a Janet Morgenstern moving in."
So not only did he sell the space, he apparently sold the name. He wasn't kidding about anyone being able to join the family. I looked over at Chris. That sounds very encouraging. How did the rest of the list check out?
I didn't have time to research them all, but the ones I could find checked out as legitimate, including Esmeralda Peña. She was the matriarch of a ranching family in Sonoma.
Did you get the info for Joel to find out who he sold the space to?
I tried. The last thing I found for him was a short obituary. He died of prostate cancer in 1983.
Where was he buried?
His ashes were scattered at sea.
No room at the inn?
Apparently.
We spilled off the bridge, and I steered the Escalade onto Interstate 580, heading towards the Broadway exit and Mountain View Cemetery. You didn't happen to look up where the Morgenstern Mausoleum was in the cemetery, did you? Chris patted the breast pocket of the jean jacket he was wearing. He smiled.
I've got a map right here. It looks to be a large crypt in the northeastern part of the grounds. It's dug into the side of a hill, just below Millionaire's Row. But August, it's bound to be locked.
Then it's a good thing I've got my picks, and that I borrowed a few heavy implements from Caesar in case.
Yes, that's good. But it's 4:40. The grounds are open until sunset. I'm sure there are people all around. You're not expecting to waltz in now and break into a mausoleum?
No, I expect you to create a diversion by tap dancing over the headstones while singing Good Ship Lollipop.
I may do drag, but I don't do Shirley Temple drag.
We ended up grabbing an early dinner at a restaurant on Piedmont Avenue and decided to kill the remainder of the time until the cemetery closed at a window table in the coffee shop I'd set in with Melina. That's when we saw the car from the private security service going onto the grounds. Justifying it as recon, we lingered as the car returned to make patrols at 7:05 and 8:05. But when the guard came out of the grounds again at 8:25, I got impatient with the waiting. I pulled Chris from the table to pile into the Escalade.
That only gives us 40 minutes,
he said as I started the car. No one ever said grave robbing was a leisurely undertaking. We pulled up to the wrought iron gates of the cemetery. I left the motor running, but killed the lights so it wouldn't be obvious I was picking the fist-sized padlock that secured the chain wrapped around them. Chris stood close beside me holding a flashlight, and except for dropping my tension wrench once, I dispatched it with relative ease. We rolled through, then paused to rewrap the chain, leaving the padlock open but twisting the shackle so it appeared like it was still engaged. It wouldn't fool the security guard at 9:05 if we were late, but it would stop the casual passerby from phoning the cops. We navigated the labyrinth of narrow asphalt roadway to the part of the cemetery where we'd hoped we'd find Morgenstern Manor. Away from the office and the other buildings near the entrance, the grounds had almost no lighting. A thin fog hovered chest high, and the beams from the Escalade's headlights falling upon the cemetery statuary through the vapor seemed almost to bring them to life. The sudden appearance, in particular, of a cracked and moss-encrusted gargoyle just about made me swallow my tongue. After a few minutes of blundering, we located the hillside Chris had identified on his map, but we found we had come upon it too far south. We crept north along the base until we spotted a large sandstone mausoleum in the shape of a Gothic arch. The name Morgenstern was carved on an inset of lighter-colored material near the keystone. Ivy grew along the sides of the structure, and the scraggly branches of an oak that jutted out from the hillside above rested along the top like an unruly cowlick. There was a decorative half-gate at the entrance we could step over, but once inside the tiny vestibule, the real security came in the form of a full-height iron door set into an interior arch. It was impossible to tell without getting inside, but I assumed the door opened into a chamber that had been carved into the hill. It was going to be real Dr. Frankenstein stuff, entering a dank underground dungeon in the middle of the night to pry open coffins. I killed the motor to the Escalade but left the headlights going to work by. It was 8:40. I told Chris to grab the toolbox from the back and went up to the half gate. It was secured with a tiny padlock like the one on the box for my father's guns, which reminded me of the Luger in the holster under my jacket. I nudged the butt of it with my left elbow for reassurance and stepped over the gate. The iron on the interior door was heavily corroded. The metal from the door's loop handle had completely rusted through in one place. The lock, however, was a different matter. Someone had drilled through the original keyhole and installed a brand of high-end deadbolt that I recognized from a flyer that had been mailed to my office. It was designed for use in government buildings, detention centers, and psychiatric wards, featured a 12-pin design, and, the flyer bragged, was virtually impossible to defeat through manipulation, meaning picking. Meaning a butterfingered private eye who could barely open a high school locker wasn't going to be unlatching it anytime soon, and certainly not before 9:05. Chris came up with the toolbox and struggled to lift it over the gate. I helped him heft it across and then held his arm while he got himself over the hurdle.
"Well?"
he said with an endearing but naive enthusiasm.
"How's it look?"
"Like shit. They've installed the mother of all deadbolts. There's no way I'm picking it." Chris looked like a kid who'd been bitten at the petting zoo, and that was just the disappointment. He'd been nervous enough at the coffee shop, but now he broke out in a rash of ticks, twitches, and shoe taps.
"What are we going to do?"
I took the flashlight from the toolbox and examined the door more thoroughly. It opened inward, so the hinges were on the other side. It would be stupid to leave them exposed, but given the advanced state of corrosion of the other metal, I wondered if the hinge pins or the bolts that held the hinges had been weakened. If I could find a way to apply pressure to the door, they might snap and the door would fall open. I dropped to my haunches and rifled through the toolbox, looking for a hammer or mallet. There was a rubber mallet at the bottom, no doubt used by Caesar to pound sheet metal, but when I lifted it out, I realized it didn't have near the mass to do the job. I needed a 16-pound sledgehammer at least, and even if I had one, the noise of banging it on the iron door would be ungodly. I cursed and wrapped my hand around my forehead to squeeze my temples. I heard Chris tapping his foot beside me.
"August, we're running out of time. We've only got 15 minutes before the security guard shows up. Maybe we should leave and come back when we've got the right tools."
I put the mallet back in the toolbox and turned to stare into the twin tunnels of light boring out from the Escalade. Chris was probably right about coming back, but I was damned if I knew what the right tool would be. The noise problem eliminated anything in the hammer or battering ram family, and the same was true of trying to pull the door off with a tow line. I needed some kind of screw or lever that I could brace against the door and the far wall of the vestibule to apply a steady and quiet pressure. "The car jack," I said.
"What?"
"We can use the jack from the Escalade to force the door open." I bounded over the gate and ran around to the back of the SUV, where I opened the rear door, pulled up the carpet and a storage tray, and finally found the jack in a compartment on the driver's side. It looked like it would extend far enough to reach the vestibule wall, and if it was meant to jack up the nearly 3-ton Escalade, it had to be strong enough. I yanked the jack, the handle, and what looked like two handle extensions out of the compartment, and rushed back towards the mausoleum. I nearly collided with Chris halfway there. The worry in his face was amplified by the stark light of the headlamps.
"The jack is a good idea, August, but we're out of time."
"I know."
"You know?"
Yeah, you've got to go back to the gate. Lock up the padlock and then hide the car somewhere on the grounds. Nowhere near here. Maybe behind the office. I'll keep working on the QT unless the guard happens by. Once he's done with his rounds, you come back and help me with the coffin.
You're kidding me.
No, I'm not. Now get to it. You've only got a few minutes. Chris hovered on one foot for a moment, but I bowled past him to the mausoleum, leaving him no one to argue with. I stepped over the gate, slipped the handle into the jack, and began extending the lift mechanism. I heard the Escalade door open and close, the engine start, and then the lights from the SUV swung past me to point back the way we had come. I reached into the toolbox for a flashlight, flicked it on, and set it down by my feet. When I had the jack extended to the point where it was only a few inches shorter than the space between the door and the back wall of the vestibule, I laid it out horizontally along the floor to attack the lowest hinge first. I figured if any of them were weak, it would be the one closest to the ground, where moisture would tend to accumulate. As the base of the jack got seated in the masonry and the tip pressed into the door, there was action on both ends. A sculpted ridge in the stonework fractured and crumbled under the base, and creepy high-pitched moaning issued from behind the door. It sounded like a cat being throttled. I continued to work the handle, and the sound increased in pitch until it ended abruptly with a muffled snap, and the bottom third of the door flexed inward. The bolts on the hinges had given up the ghost. I unwound the jack and paused to glance at my watch. It was now 9:12. The security guard should be on the grounds, and hopefully Chris had found a place to hide the Escalade. I hoisted the jack to a point about midway up the door with one hand and tried to work the handle with the other. It was awkward going. The handle kept slipping out of his coupling, and I found it difficult to hold the jack parallel to the ground. Finally, I put it back on the floor to extend it the full width of the gap between the door and the wall. I lifted it again to wedge the base against the back wall at the right height, and then swung the tip around and hammered it in tight against the door using the rubber mallet. As the reverberation from the pounding died away, the sound of an automobile engine wafted through the fog. I reached down to kill the light and pressed myself against the opposite wall of the vestibule. Based on the short duration of the security patrols, I had assumed that the guard couldn't cover the full grounds every time, and hoped that this part of the cemetery would be excluded. No such luck. If he was just passing by as part of a routine patrol, I was in pretty good shape. The vestibule provided cover, and the guard would almost certainly need to get out of his car to see anything amiss with the mausoleum. If, on the other hand, he was coming in response to my pounding, I was screwed. I would have to decide fast whether I was desperate enough to pull the Luger on him to prevent him from derailing my plans. What made it especially hard was I had no way of knowing for certain that Evita was behind door number one. The sound of the car grew louder, and the diffuse glow of its headlights lit up the area by the road. I heard tires on damp pavement, and then the squeal of brakes. I risked a look out the vestibule and saw the nose of a car parked just in front of the mausoleum. I pressed myself back against the wall as tight as I could and slipped the Luger into my hand. The car door popped open, shoe leather scraped asphalt, and then a reedy voice said,
"Morgenstern, eh? I dated a Miriam Morgenstern once, never got anywhere with it."
For lack of any other clue, I assumed the remarks were addressed to me. I raised the Luger and started to inch it around the stonework of the mausoleum arch. Then I heard the unmistakable sound of a fly being unzipped, and after a longish pause, the faint sound of water hitting grass.
"Here's to you, Miriam,"
said the reedy voice. I yanked the Luger back and retreated into the vestibule. Pissing on people's graves, even by proxy, was apparently a perk in the cemetery security business. The guard took his sweet time finishing his business, but eventually climbed back into the car and drove past the mausoleum. I got a brief glance at him as he passed, his face lit by the greenish glow of the dashboard display. He looked like the sort of guy who would be building a model of the Titanic in his basement with Lego blocks. I was embarrassed for even having drawn the gun. I gave him another minute or so to get clear of the area and then flicked on the flashlight. I fitted the handle into the jack and began cranking it open once more. The second hinge went much the way of the first, and it wasn't long before I was lining up for the final one at the top of the door. I had to stand on the toolbox to get the jack situated just right. I pumped the handle, 1, 2, 3 full strokes. This time, the sound coming from the chamber was duller and lower pitched, and the handle was much harder to ratchet. It eventually got so hard that I had to put on the handle extensions. In the end, I was hanging from the handle, bouncing up and down to generate enough force to move the teeth in the gear. All at once, there was a sound like firecrackers going off. The handle ratcheted freely to the 6 o'clock position, and I hit the stone floor with the two extensions beating down on me like lead drumsticks. The iron door fell open into the burial chamber at a 30-degree slant, only the deadbolt on the other side preventing it from dropping all the way in. I was giving my bruised tuchus a much-needed massage when Chris pulled up in the Escalade. I could tell immediately something was different. He'd lost his look of concern, along with all the attendant ticks and twitches. He grinned at me as he flounced up to the mausoleum. "You seem pretty pleased with yourself," I said. "How'd you make out?"
"Piece of cake." I relocked the padlock, then zip-zip. I ran the SUV behind the office and parked it with several of the cemetery vehicles. I even camouflaged it with a magnetic sign I took from one of the Mountain View cars. It seems I have a knack for this private eye stuff.
I believe the term the cops use is breaking and entering. Did the guard come by where you were hiding?
Drove right by without stopping. What have you been up to?
I gestured to the broken door behind me. What does this look like? Hail damage?
Good to see you've been productive. Now all we need to do is rescue Evita.
He stepped over the gate and came up to the unhinged door to rap his knuckles on it.
"Sleeping Beauty,"
he called out in a stage whisper.
"Time for the big wake-up."
You have been listening to The Big Wake-Up, a book Publishers Weekly described as outstanding in a starred review. Find it in ebook or trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com.